On this week's 51%, we hear about leading from the feminine.
The way that our culture has valued the masculine in us as human beings and devalued the, quote, feminine in us as human beings, I believe is part of that legacy, and that it's true in men as it is in women.
Meet a singer-songwriter who embraces her black girl magic, and the first woman in a certain Coast Guard role retires. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I've delivered us to where we are. I have journeyed farther. I am everything I've learned and more. Still it calls me.
What if the root of all the world's problems is the imbalance of masculinity and femininity in our leadership? Social entrepreneur Nina Simons, co-founder of Bioneers in 1990 in Santa Fe, New Mexico, has spent more than 20 years investigating the power of femininity to solve some of humanity's greatest challenges, both environmental and social, convening in an annual conference. Bioneers is a nonprofit educational organization that highlights breakthrough solutions for restoring people and planet. In part one of an interview, Simon spoke with KALW's Inflection Point host, Lauren Schiller, about how leading from the feminine began and the start of her career.
What I really wanted to do was work in theater. But the theater that I really wanted to do was theater that really challenged people's belief systems. And I called it transformational theater. And so early in my adult life, I started trying to do that and realized it could be a very hard path to make a living at. And so I got kind of disillusioned, and I managed restaurants. I did all kinds of things. And I discovered along the way that I had a gift for communicating with passion about things I believed in. And I had a mentor tell me, Nina, you could sell ice to Eskimos. And I remember thinking that was one of the creepiest gifts I could ever. I thought, what good is that? That's yucky. But when I realized that I could use that skill to market ideas, I began to get interested in it. And then I started working for Seeds of Change, which was the first biodiversity organic seed company that really had a mission of spreading biodiversity back into the food system by working with an army of backyard gardeners. And I felt like I was serving nature and serving the essence of life. And it felt very sacred to me, even though it was a social venture. So I did that for a time. And then I worked for Odwalla, the fresh juice company, well before it got acquired by Coca-Cola, and when we were really idealistic and were basically selling a healthy lifestyle and great juice to people. So that was some of my background before I headed back into the nonprofit world.
But as you made your way through your career and discovered what your skills and talents were, how did you think of yourself as a leader?
You know, Lauren, I don't think I ever thought of myself as a leader. I mean, I think in a certain way, now that I can reflect back on it, that in some ways my tendency to be extroverted and love connecting with people was a tremendous skill and asset for me. And it caused me to be sort of a natural leader. And to the extent that I really thought about it, I think that I was just kind of following what I understood that I did well. And that meant building teams of people and helping groups orient toward a common vision and a common goal. And with Seeds of Change, I remember discovering that I had a knack for business. And I had never been to business school, but discovering that I was good at managing budgets and writing business plans was like a total surprise to me. And what I realized was that as long as I was really honest about saying what I didn't know, and that the people who I was working with were okay with that, then I could stumble my way along and learn as I went. And it seemed as though whatever those natural pragmatic talents that I had around business and people served me well. So I didn't think that much about it until later in my life, in my late 30s, when I began to be acknowledged as a leader. And I had been working with Bioneers and developing this annual conference, which I came to realize some years later, actually fulfilled my dream of doing transformational theater, but in a whole different form than I could ever have imagined. But anyway, so I remember that I got acknowledged by a magazine, the Utney Reader, for being an up-and-coming leader. And I remember being horrified. I really was so uncomfortable about it. I wasn't even sure why I was so uncomfortable. But what I realized afterwards was that I felt like it painted a target on my chest. And like it was, it felt egotistical, and it felt like a label that I had never aspired to. And so I began this inquiry about leadership. It really set me on a journey to understand. I think I had learned from pioneers that what the world needs most is leadership from everyone. And so I thought, well, if I have this reaction to being called a leader, then maybe other people do too. And the more women I talked to, the more I learned that most women have a really negative reaction to calling themselves leaders. And so I really began to unpack that and realized that I had all these belief systems and images and ideas that I had never consciously adopted, but that were in me nonetheless, about what leadership was and what it looked like. And I didn't want to be any of those things.
It's so interesting because especially nowadays where everyone is trying to get their 15 minutes of fame through, you know, their personal brand on social media and putting as many photos of themselves and selfies, you know, out there as they possibly can to create. I mean, talk about putting a target on your chest. It's
like, exactly.
Here I am.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then this idea of being featured in a magazine as, you know, a person of the year, or at that time it was probably man of the year for Time.
No, it was an up-and-coming leader under 40.
Right. Well, right? I would say many people probably put that as a career goal.
Right, right.
And yet your reaction to it was
so
opposite.
Negative.
Yeah.
Well, and I think part of that was because I grew up with a mother and a role model in my head that said service is good and self is selfishness and not so good. And so I think my sense of identity was really built around service and being of service to the greater good. And then included in that, you know, I've had the gift of, through producing pioneers, witnessing hundreds and hundreds of leaders from all backgrounds and walks of life. And what I realized, you know, part of my inquiry about leadership involved reading like hundreds of transcripts of talks that had been given at pioneers, because I thought, well, if I don't want to be a leader in that old model, in that inherited model that I didn't like, that seemed aggressive and dominating and charismatic and but putting other people down, I don't know, I had all kinds of associations like that, then I thought, well, who are the leaders that really inspire me? So let me get clear about that. And what are they doing that I could emulate and perhaps grow into? I did this in order to do a book, which I edited, called Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart. What I found when I read all those transcripts and I looked for the themes and the patterns was that the ones that I really respected and admired were humble. They were leading because of something that they really loved and felt passionate about. And most often, they didn't have formal training to do it. No one gave them a degree or a job or a crown, but they served something they really believed in. And through that, they attracted other people to get involved. And in many cases, they led collaboratively. They led by raising up other leaders, of course. And they were not really interested in being in the spotlight. And that was the kind of leader I really wanted to be.
And when you were going through all of these transcripts, were these all women leaders that you were looking at? Or did you start with men and women and then it filtered out
well,
a certain way?
I have to admit to having had a certain bias for women at that point. I had an epiphany moment earlier in my life when someone turned me on to a film that was made in the early 90s. And it's a film that anyone can find online by looking up the name. It's called The Burning Times, and it was the second in a trilogy that was made by a Canadian woman filmmaker, and it basically tells the story of the 300-year period in European history where, you know, historians can't agree on the numbers, but somewhere between 50,000 and millions of women were systematically persecuted and tortured and burned for the supposed crime of being witches. I mean, the film is a little dated, but it still tells the story better than anything I've ever seen. And when I saw it, I had so many deep, deep reactions. One was that I knew that the story and the legacy of that time was still alive in my bones, that somehow there was a genetic memory that I knew I had. And it explained for the first time a fear that I had had that I'd never understood about speaking my truth in public, about what really was important to me. And The Burning Times and learning the history of that time made sense of it for me. And it also changed my worldview, because for the first time, I saw that all of the problems that I had learned about from pioneers could be seen as a function of the imbalance between the masculine and the feminine in our culture. And so what I saw was not only a root story that described to me why women tend to be positioned to be in catfights and competition with each other, but also why we often see each other as scary because of the legacy of that. Six generations of children watch their mothers and sisters and aunts and grandmothers get burned. And as I investigated and researched it after seeing the movie, I learned that there was a whole economy that built up around this, and that there were more women alive at the beginning of the Burning Times than men, which changed during the course of the Burning Times. And all of these social systems and institutions like medicine went from the purview of women, who had been the herbalists and the midwives and the hospice workers. They were the first to get persecuted and burned. And by the end of the Burning Times, only men could practice medicine. You had to go to college to practice medicine, and only men were allowed.
What years was the spanning?
Well, it was from about the 1400s through the 1700s. You know, and as I researched it, I found that it happened in every major country in Europe, and that there was an equivalent to it in one way or another that happened in other continents as well. So, of course, you know, in this country, we are largely influenced by a Eurocentric culture. But even what I found was even women who were of African descent and Latin American descent, and there was a kind of flipping of the spirituality that, of course, happened during that time, because it went from a largely earth goddess honoring culture to a patriarchy, where religion was practiced in a church and led by a priest and intermediated. Before the Burning Times, the way that people experienced their own spirituality was through their direct connection with nature and the divine. And after the Burning Times, it was all mediated. So, I mean, I just got fascinated with this root story and why every child didn't learn this in school. You know, we learned about the Salem witch trials.
Right. I've never heard of it.
I know. It's a huge story. And for me, it's fascinating, and it explains a lot. So I did have a bias toward women when I was reading all those transcripts. And I also knew that the way that our culture has valued the masculine in us as human beings and devalued the, quote, feminine in us as human beings, I believe is part of that legacy, and that it's true in men as it is in women. So all of us, regardless of our temporary gender assignment, you know, have that imbalance as a legacy of our culture, I believe. And so there's a lot of inner work to do. So what I found in reading all the transcripts was that there were men who were personifying leading from the heart. And it became important to me to include some men in the book. So I did. You know, my publisher was very uncertain and said, "Are you sure? This is a women's book. Why are we putting men in here?" I said, "Because we have to." And so I'm glad I did.
What would you say that the things people value in a leader are, and what percentage of them would you say are considered masculine traits?
I think that the traits that people value in leaders of yesteryear have been a kind of charisma and aggression, strength and endurance and perseverance. Not that any of those things are bad. I mean, of course, they're all great. But I believe we're living in a time now, and a lot of social science research bears this out. There's a great book called The Athena Doctrine, and it says that 67% of the people that they polled in 13 nations around the world said the world would be a better place if more people led like women. And there's evidence from all sectors that the more women that are in leadership, in corporations, and on boards, the better their bottom line. And the more women are doing negotiating and peacekeeping in the world, the more peaceful things are. And, you know, on and on. The evidence is pretty astounding, and it's coming from every direction. And it's not about putting down men. It's about saying we're all in a giant shift. You know, to me, one of my favorite reference points is a phrase that an indigenous people from the global south say, which is that the bird of humanity has been trying to fly with only one wing for far too long, and it needs to be balanced.
That was Nina Simons, co-founder of Bioneers, speaking with Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller, produced at KALW in San Francisco. Hear Schiller's other conversations at inflectionpointradio.org and on her Inflection Point podcast. Becoming a musician was not an easy decision for Mayada. The 24-year-old singer-songwriter had to soul search, face racism, and have a difficult conversation with her mother. KFAI's Zan Holston has a story on how she learned to embrace her black girl magic.
On the West Bank of Minneapolis, I'm Zan Holston. The first time I see Mayada, I'm struck by her style. She's wearing lots of colorful jewelry. Big rings grace most of her fingers, loose, bulky bracelets frame her wrists, and her long, ropey braids hang down to her mid-back. Then I'm struck by her singing.
Well, I was that little girl, learning hatred for my curls, and I tried to burn them straight.
That's Mayada Major, who goes by the stage name of Mayada, performing an acoustic version of Black Girl Magic. It's a bittersweet song that takes on the Disneyfied image of the white princess, and it's also a reclamation of identity. It's part of a series of songs she wrote about media images of black bodies as victims of violence. It touches on her reaction to the police killing of a black man in Ferguson, Missouri.
Mike Brown was murdered, and I think that was like the sparking point, which is ridiculous because I've been black my whole life. But like, that was the sparking point where I was like, okay, all of these things are tying together, and like, they're also related to how I practice my faith. And I'm not about to sit here and like look at injustice.
If you spend any amount of time talking to Mayada, her faith in God comes up.
I don't think I'd be doing music if it wasn't for my faith. So I don't know. I think it's just like it really informs my worldview in general. So of course it's going to inform my songwriting.
For her, that doesn't mean writing songs that extol the virtues of God, but writing songs that take listeners on a spiritual path that leaves them in a better place at the end than where they started. Mayada almost didn't become a singer. Her mother is Liberian. She came to the U.S. to attend graduate school at Duke University, and she moved to North Minneapolis where she raised Mayada and her little brother. In some ways, they had a childhood driven by the need to excel.
That whole immigrant, like, idea of, like, education, like, it's very strong with her and, like, with like in my house. So it was like, okay, if I have to sacrifice any other kind of comfort for my kids to be, like, well-educated, and then also she was like, oh, wow, yeah, racism's a thing in this country, so I need to give my kids the best chance that I possibly can.
That meant sending them to private school, and later, private colleges. As she neared graduation in 2015, Mayada had surprising news for her mother.
Came home for winter break and told my immigrant mother, like, oh, yeah, I know you sacrificed for me to go to all these really good schools, like, my entire life, but I really feel like God's, like, leading me to be a musician.
Mayada didn't expect a positive reaction, but she was surprised.
And she didn't freak out. Like, not only did she not freak out, she's been really supportive.
In fact, her mother just continued on helping her find resources.
she's being a scientist about it, really. Like, okay, like, this is all the research we need to do. Like, these are the things you need to do. Like, she's just being very organized, and that's who she is, so.
But where Mayada's mother is a planner, Mayada's philosophy is more, God tells you where to be, you show up and work. And so far, putting her faith in God is working. She just spent a few months in Los Angeles getting vocal training. The results were encouraging.
At the end of the evaluation, she was like, well, the good news is you didn't come out here for nothing. Like, you are singing way under your capacity.
Her coach taught her how to really sing from her diaphragm.
I'm kind of relearning how to sing my own songs, because before it'd be like, okay, I want it to sound really powerful, so I need to, like, press the pedal to the gas, like, just gun it, right? And now to get that same effect, it's like 60% of the effort.
I recently saw Mayada play a set on piano and guitar at the Vieux Carré in downtown St. Paul. It was a mellow Saturday night and the crowd was thin. Patrons sipped their drinks, ordered gumbo and Sazeracs, and clapped respectfectully. A triple date of 40-something black professionals sat in the corner, and they were digging the show. But when Mayada launched into Black Girl Magic, I saw them, especially the women, light up. They knew exactly what she was saying.
So if you're thin or thick or poor or rich, or they call you a bitch, I'm talking to y'all. If you're loud or shy, whether you read or write, if you're dark or light, I'm talking to y'all. If you're young or old,
for KFAI, I'm Sam Holston.
The telling all get told, I'm talking to y'all. If you're on tiptoe, we're dropping it low. I got no rhythm to show. I'm talking to y'all because we got Black Girl Magic. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Black Girl Magic, we got.
For the first time, the U.S. Marine Corps is eyeing a plan to let women attend what has been male-only combat training in Southern California, as officials work to quash recurring problems with sexism and other bad behavior among Marines. That's according to Marine Corps officials. If approved by senior Marine leaders, the change could happen as soon as next spring. The officials said Marine leaders also are considering allowing women to attend boot camp in San Diego. Currently, all women recruits go through boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina, while male recruits go either there or to San Diego. The combat training comes after troops have finished boot camp and is done both in South Carolina and at Camp Pendleton in Southern California, but women attend the course only on the East Coast. The officials were not authorized to publicly discuss the matter because final decisions have not yet been made, so they spoke on condition of anonymity. The boot camp decision is still under discussion. Meanwhile, the first woman to lead the Coast Guard district that covers the Great Lakes retired recently. Elizabeth Miller of Great Lakes Today has details on her exit and who's taking her place.
In the 2 years Rear Admiral June Ryan has been commander of the 9th District, the winters have been mild, and there hasn't really been a need for icebreaking, what she calls the Coast Guard Great Lakes' greatest challenge. But she says there's another challenge, one that she'll continue to fight for even after she retires. It comes with increased recreational boating on the Great Lakes, especially people using kayaks and canoes.
Our greatest challenge is a lot of them don't wear life jackets, and then they're very easy. Canoes and kayaks are very easy to tip over, and so they end up in the water more frequently than any other boater.
Statistics show it's a big problem. Nationwide, 83% of boating accident victims who drowned last year were not wearing a life jacket. Ryan is retiring to stay in Cleveland with her family. She's had a lot of firsts in her career. She was the first woman in Coast Guard history to go from enlisted all the way to admiral. And for her last first, Ryan is passing the torch to another woman, Rear Admiral Joanna Noonan. Noonan says she looks forward to continuing the work Ryan has done and maintaining communication with federal, state, and local partners, including Canada. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of WBFO Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester. For more stories, visit greatlakestoday.org. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1465.